All right, time for Truth About Markets with Max and Stacy, coming to you from Belfast.
Indeed. This is my first time ever in Belfast. We're here to report and observe the anti-G8 protests. Of course, we're not going out to Farnham, the Potemkin village in which the G8 will be held on Monday. But we're here. We're actually staying in West Belfast, and which we didn't know, of course, at the time. But this is the Sinn Féin area, and where the where all the events are is over in the non-Sinn Féin area.
Oh yeah. Well, I didn't see a lot of indications of that. Kind of subtle, I guess. But you know, this is a town that's divided. We were at an event last night with George Galloway. And talking about the G8 event, and I was interested in the questions that came up, because most of the questions were along the lines of sectarian divisions, I'd say.
Yeah, those were the questions from the audience in the Q&A session at the end. And I was surprised, because your talk and then Galloway's talk were all about finance, economics, markets, global stuff. And about half the questions were about, I'm an Ulster Unionist, what should I think about this G8 thing? You know, it was always like they identified what, you know, sectarian division, what side of the equation they were on.
Yeah, that was surprising, I guess, because it seems, I mean, the answer that came back from the panel was that, you know, you should not think of yourself in this way, but rather as somebody who's fighting against the common enemy of the banksters and the G8 people. You know, I think that's got it. But that's what I found wherever I go around the world. There's always local divisions, whether it's the Sunni-Shia conflict in Beirut, or the Democrat-Republican conflict in America, or the Unionist and the Catholic Protestant divide in Belfast. There's always some local squabble that is preventing the economies of scale from taking place that would be effective in fighting the encroachment of the public space by the privateers and the racketeers.
Yeah, and it also does divide you from the global community, in that it's very hard to understand when you're here, actually. Like, who's who and why you should care at all. Like, you don't know why they're so divided. They look and seem and act and talk the same to you, but there are all these little signifiers everybody's looking for.
Yeah, everyone is completely, like, you know, living in a fishbowl, basically. And it's all very important locally, but once you leave, it's completely uninteresting and nobody really follows it. But so the G8 folks are coming together. This is another confab. So we were at the Bilderberg, and now we're at the G8. This is the G20, the G8. Then there's the G20, and then there's all these gatherings around the world where the re-architecture of the world is unfortunately being re-architected and recreated in the image of a rather voraciously opportunistic private company.
Yeah, well, a few things there. First of all, we mentioned local news. The Belfast Telegraph today has nothing about the G8. In fact, they have Lollipop Lady Eileen gets Queen's honor after 45 years on the job. I guess the lollipop lady, they consider that the person who, the traffic warden for the little school kids. It's only on page 6 that they finally talk about the G8. And, of course, it reflects what we have today is a global Roman-like empire in America. This is what a lockdown looks like. And, of course, there's photos of police state all over the place, and Marine One, which is President Obama's helicopter, he's already in town. And the other thing you mentioned was the privatization. And we just heard from William Banzai 7, who is, you know, the financial artist. And he got a takedown notice from Zazzle because he had some of his artwork up there with NSA. Mm. And NSA claimed copyright.
Right. Well, this is the ongoing copyright conflict, isn't it? The copyright law, which is already controversial when it was created hundreds of years ago, the idea of protecting intellectual property. And then, of course, Thomas Jefferson didn't think there was anything. Intellectual property was an oxymoron. You can't have property rights assigned to ideas. But nevertheless, they started intellectual property laws, copyright laws, patent laws. And over the past 200 years, but in particular over the past 50 years, when Disney Corporation decided to lobby for copyright extension acts every 20 years, at around the time when the Mickey Mouse was due to enter the public domain, has been extended. And now it's used to be part of this steel fence that's dividing society between those with unlimited access to cheap money and insider trading through Prism and the NSA platform, and everybody else. And so the NSA claims copyright to the NSA. Of course, it's a public utility. It's a publicly owned enterprise. It was anyway up until now. Now it's considered to be like the Walt Disney Corporation is the NSA. And so they're claiming copyright as a way to stifle dissent, stifle free speech, stifle the right to assemble, curb any kind of constitutional or Bill of Rights that would be in place to give people the right to oppose. You know, a lot of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution gives people the right to oppose those in power. And the theory is that if you have an active opposition, you're always going to be arguing points to take the greater good forward. But all of this recent rollback of all the constitutional rights and Bill of Rights in America and around the world means no opposition. So now you just have one party, the party, the Communist Party, as we remember, as always, I work for the party. I am a member, a party member. So the NSA is a party member. Obama is a party member. Oracle Software, Google, AOL, Facebook, they're all party members. And they come to your home and they check through your linen and they go through your papers and they make sure that the party is satisfied with you. And if you're lucky, you'll be asked to become a party member.
Yeah, well, that was the other thing about the event yesterday, is everybody really insists on talking about capitalism and we need, you know, that capitalism has done this and capitalism has caused this austerity. When, you know, the system we have right now under the U.S. empire is very similar to what the Soviet Union had in terms of what the Soviet Union had in relation to communism is about as much as what the U.S. empire has in relation to capitalism. It's the same sort of gangster state of preferred monopolists who have the apparatus of the state to wipe out and like take out competition and prevent it. And price fixing, rigged markets, the same thing for the same reason.
Yeah, that's right. The words, the you know, the video before the Galloway Kaiser panel here in Belfast yesterday featured, I'd say, 15 or so talking heads, including Noam Chomsky and others. And the common theme was that capitalism stinks. It hasn't worked. It doesn't work. And but the alternative is to go towards something called socialism, essentially. But socialism doesn't work either. So, you know, if given the choice, are you a capitalist or a socialist? As I've been saying all along here, I'm more in the camp of the capitalist than I am in the camp of the socialist, because the socialist more or less means a single top-down hierarchical approach to management, which means that you are depriving the society of the dynamism that comes with multiple decision makers competing with each other for the best outcome. So I'm definitely, we've seen that doesn't work. So, you know, the free market has some successes to count on. It right currently it has many problems because it's been deprived of the competitiveness of that market. It's become a monolithic fascist version of capitalism. I mean, fascism is not capitalism. when you combine the state and the corporations and give everyone the right of immunity under a corporate veil, and the NSA can harass people for trademark laws. I mean, that's not capitalism, that's fascism, which is a strain of capitalism that is obviously as bad as socialism.
Well, that's the thing as well, though, is that, everybody, you could trace the decline in wages, for example, in America and around the world, and the rise of debt to not only the departure from the U.S. gold standard against the rest of the world anyway, and the end of communism. You know, Paul Craig Roberts, I think, rightly pointed out a few years ago that was one of the worst things to happen to the U.S. economy, in that it no longer had to compete as an ideology, whatever form of capitalism we had at that time. So when now it no longer has to compete, it's the Al Capone, the thug. Nobody will dare challenge it. This is it. And they create these global trade deals, like Trans-Pacific Partnership, which, as Adam Smith predicted, these global corporations in the same business get together and collude with contracts that prevent any competition from ever emerging.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, you know, you do see some hybrid models emerging in a big way. I mean, the crowdfunding model is really taking off in a huge way. There are now many, many variations on this crowdfunding model, which is a combination, really, of the certain aspects of socialism and certain properties of capitalism. So when you have people coming together as a group, a social network, the name is right there in the phrase social network. The social network / socialism is contributing small amounts of money to projects that are competing in a very capitalistic way on a platform like Indiegogo is, and now there's probably 30 or 40 different versions of this. That's a hybrid model that combines some elements of socialism and some elements of capitalism. And that's an emerging model that is combining both elements. And we see it in the currency. For example, Bitcoin, again, is a hybrid model. It's a hybrid of different systems. It's got its foot in both camps to some degree. So beneath the surface of this failed, I wouldn't say that capitalism and socialism, it's either one or the other, and one's better than the other. The fact is that they are both, what you would say, are coterminous. They have both. When the Berlin Wall went down, it was the death of both communism and capitalism. It was the both died. And now 20, 25, 30 years later, we have the emergence of a hybrid model.
Yeah. I mean, certainly capital itself has far too many rights in the system we have now compared to what the labor, humans, people, citizens, consumers have. They don't have very many rights at all, the human being, compared to capital, which has a lot of rights and can travel freely. It's not padded down at the border. You know, it just goes wherever it wants, and we humans get trapped behind. That's naturally going to cause an imbalance, by the way, and choke points in the free trade, if you're trying to have free trade. Now, the other thing, of course, is, you know, we showed on one of the episodes of Kai's report this week a chart from one of the slides from the NSA about where they're spying. And, of course, where they're not spying is the area to look for in terms of the next phases of where the economy will go. And, of course, they're doing very little spying in Africa. So that's also, by the way, where you see some of the most innovation in the world happening is in Africa, in terms of mobile payments, how they think of money, how they store money, how they transmit money, how they, you know, transact with each other.
Yeah, that's the whole continent is going down the path of a hybrid model where you've got a complete revolution in the way money is transacted and stored and used as a medium of exchange, and cutting out all of the banks, essentially, there are very innovative new business models that are being developed and it's becoming a very exciting place for economic development in that way. And I guess we should also mention, the big story of the day, which I just can't I can't s describe this any other way, but the big story is what we just saw in freaking China.
Yes, it is pretty amazing. So there's a photo, there's some sort of festival, and the photos from China are of over 10,000 people lined up to buy some gold at a gold shop, waiting for a gold shop to open. When you and my immediate thought is to juxtapose that image to two different things. One is the protests here against the economic and financial system, which are just waving placards and doing nothing really. And the other is, of course, the American consumer lined up outside Walmart, bashing their each other's heads in to go, but get a 20% discount off of some Chinese-made, plastic good.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a big comparison there because the people who are protesting here at the G8, the bottom line, the message is that they don't trust these government leaders. They don't trust them. The trust has been broken, and for good reason, because you see the economy and has become quite precarious, and the foreign policies, the war policies, the war profiteering policies are insane. So there's no trust. The trust is broken. So the reaction is to come out to a G8 meeting and protest the G8 meeting and wave placards and create huge papier-mâché puppets and have meetings and strum a guitar and play a bongo. In China, also now, the trust has broken down because their economy, after a big 20, 30-year run, is now starting to fall apart. The people don't trust the government anymore. They don't trust them the way that they have been trusting them. So their response is to buy gold because that's what people do when trust in the government and the central planners falls away. They buy gold, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy because on the margins, all this physical buying will overcome the paper selling that is kept a ceiling on prices for 10 or 15 years. So this physical buying of gold and silver will bust through that paper ceiling, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So those people in China who are buying here at $1,400, $1,500 an ounce, they'll be rewarded when the price is at $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 an ounce, and their mistrust of the government will be rewarded. But they're monetizing their mistrust of the government, whereas just waving a placard around at a G8 meeting without buying gold, it seems, and pining for the good old days when there was a communist manifesto that was working, 150 years ago. I'm not sure how that works.
Speaking of distrust, here's another story that we'll be talking about on the next Kaiser Report from the UK, right here. I guess we told you so. I mean, actually, I don't even think we predicted it would be so, just violent, basically, against UK students. So, the top-up fees. Well, there's a pool of outstanding loans of between 35 and 40 billion pounds. Those are the loans from 1998 to 2012. And they are fixed at base rate plus 1%. So, as we know, the base rate is 0.5%, not 0.5% right now. So, student loans are only carrying interest rates of 1.5%. Well, the coalition government wants to sell off this package of 40 billion pounds worth of student loans, student debt. And Rothschild's bank has informed them that in a report now released through a Freedom of Information Act request, that in fact, a good way to attract buyers would be for them to retroactively raise interest rates, break the contract, by the way. Remember those sacrosanct contracts that were so sacrosanct for, say, the unsecured bondholders of Anglo-Irish Bank that we must pay off, we must pay 100 cents on the dollar. The same thing happened to Greece, the same thing happened to Portugal and Spain. these contracts with bankers were sacrosanct. Well, the contract you signed as a student, apparently they want to retroactively raise it to RPI, the Retail Price Index, plus 3%. Because Rothschild informs the government that, you know, investors are worried that they'll lose money through inflation.
Well, as you point out, the contract clause and defense is interesting because, again, you know, in Ireland, they have to pay that the billion pound tranche of debt to bail out the bank, the Fitzpatrick Bank there. And they keep saying, oh, you know, it's the contract and it's the moral thing to do. It's the right thing to do. We have to pay this contract, even though the debt was foisted upon them illegally. They say, oh, well, we have to pay off the debt. It's the contract. Meanwhile, when it comes to the other side of the equation, they're saying, well, contracts don't matter at all. You know, you have a student contract, but we're just going to break it because Rothschild Bank decided that in order to sell off this 40 billion pound tranche of debt, we have to make it more attractive. And, well, why are they selling it off? Who are they selling it off to? Well, you know, when groups like the IMF and these other people come in to restructure Europe, you know, the IMF is broke. They don't have any money. The IMF, the only money the IMF has is the money that they get after they invade a country like Greece and then sell the assets off to investors. It's basically a leveraged buyout. So the government in the UK is broke, as we know. They're insolvent. So they need to use the strong-arm tactics of coercion and the threat of prison to get students to break, have their contract broken so that they can sell off this debt to a global financier to make the fee, to keep them afloat so that they can keep power. So it's pretty heinous. I mean, the students, of course, they say that the debt now could span the entire working life of the student and of the professional. So you're being thrown into permanent debt indentured. This is really, I was pretty shocked by this, because this is the worst example of government overreach I've seen in the UK in 20 years, I think. This is really the worst thing I've seen in 20 years.
Well, importantly, you see this over and over. So we've started talking about the local petty sectarian issues, and that this is what most people absorb their time with. These are the stories that are important to them to ask in Q&A sessions, to talk about in the pub. And yet what we've seen on every single level of this is that are these democratically elected governments that we spend so much energy and time thinking about and engaged in petty disputes with, well, they sell off those. They have no obligations through selling off and privatizing and selling these. So like with Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, all those debts, those unsecured bondholders of Anglo-Irish are foreign banks. The Thames Water, all the privatized water systems in the UK, they're owned by foreign private equity firms or foreign multinationals, so that the government can just say, well, I care about you, the voter, who might vote me and put me in a position of power, but there's nothing I can do. I'm helpless. The same thing with this NSA thing. What is emerging is that the NSA says they only spied on foreigners. Well, it's turning out what happens is, to avoid domestic laws against such totalitarian systems, the USA is spying on UK citizens and the UK is spying on American citizens, and they swap the information so that they don't break their domestic laws. But they're abrogating their responsibility in a loophole.
Right. Right. These other foreign countries are spying on Americans. And so America buys that data in exchange for that also infers that they're selling all the spying information that they have on Americans to foreign powers. So, but of course, they see it as just the same, different parts of the same balance sheet. So Google is a global corporation, and whether they're, and just like they have their accounting where they pay no taxes, you know, in Ireland, they end up paying less than 1/100% in tax because of their ability to pick and choose at any given moment what law in what territory they want to comply with. Same too with this breach of law in terms of spying on people. They end up being able to pick and choose what law they want to comply with, and so the net result is that they have a full complete package of spying on everyone in the world, essentially, is using Google, which has billions of users, and combine that with all the other networking platforms, and you have complete spy network. And so, you know, it's a ring of steel where and neo-feudalism. I think more people are hearkening back to this feudalism period where you have lords, essentially, who live in castles, and everyone else is just kind of living in misery.
Well, so that's that. Hey, by the way, I see people live tweeting. You know, we're recording this in the morning because we're going to go out to the protests, which start right now. It's 9 in the morning. So we're going to go out there in 3 hours when the protests start, see what happens. I see people live tweeting our latest show. We had an interesting interview with Lee Camp. I think you should go over to maxkaiser.com and watch that interview, because he compares billionaires to the average hoarder. You know, you see these stories all the time in the Daily Mail, some hoarder who dies when their pile of Coca-Cola cans falls on top of them and crushes them. You know, these, you know who hoarders are. There's even a TV show in America about hoarders, a reality fly on the wall TV show sort of thing. And yet he had an interesting way of viewing them as, why do we view these as guys that we want to talk to and seek economic and financial advice from when they're just as bat poop crazy as, you know, these hoarders?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting way to look at things. It's, you know, people who hoard odd things like placemats from diners or something, and they have a room full of them. It's similar to the billionaire class that typically just have roomfuls of money. That it's not, they're not doing anything with it. They're not circulating it. They're not really spending it. They're just hoarding roomfuls of money. And it's, we look at these shows of hoarders, and the thought is that they're sick in some way. They have a disease called hoarding. People are believe that this is a social kind of you're suffering from a mental disorder. Same thing with these hoarders of cash. You know, it's just, for some reason, some people like to hoard cash, and it is a problem of a mental disorder as anything else, as a point of the routine, which is a lot of merit to it, I think.
Well, even, you know, Sandeep Jaitley always talks about this with gold hoarders. You know, it's been a concept for a very long time. It used to be a concept that somebody was sick in the head if they didn't circulate their gold. This is the point of money. It was meant to circulate and transact, and business was supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. But the concept of hoarding is obviously you're withdrawing from the loop of life. You know, you're separating yourself out and sitting out in this weird protest, I guess, at society.
Well, in the case of hoarding gold, you know, stacking silver and accumulating gold, you know, this is a direct result of fear of the collapse, fear of government. And gold is money, always has been and always will be, whereas placemats and diner placemats or Federal Reserve promissory notes that are just like a placemat at a diner, it's just a printed piece of paper. Hoarding those, it makes little sense. But if, in fact, the government caters to diseased individuals who like to hoard pieces of paper, and, you know, Warren Buffett's just an attic full of junk, basically. Mm-hmm. He's got railroad tracks and Dairy Queen cups, and, you know, the guy's a toxic river of junk. He's been hoarding for 30 years, and of course he hates gold because gold is actual money. You know, that's not what he's into. He's into hoarding, you know, kitsch. And so when all that stuff starts to lose, when people lose faith in it and dump it, and we see this in China right now, they turn to protecting themselves And the only way to do that, historically, going back thousands of years, is to have gold to protect yourself against the government's gone crazy. That's why in 1930s, when after a period of hoarding and silliness, the government confiscated the gold in America and then revalued it in a way that ripped people off because those who did not trust the government ended up accumulating a lot of gold, and then that would mean that the government is out of business because the government didn't have any, they only had paper, and so to preserve their power, we know what happened from there.
Well, actually, that's what Professor Fiketa also says in his latest piece that we posted on our site. The price of gold is headed for extinction. In that, he was saying that in a healthy, functioning, normal, free market system, you wouldn't hoard gold because you would want to be transacting because prices would reflect supply and demand. And when you start hoarding gold, he said is a design feature of the gold standard. One would hoard gold when the government policies and inflation and price mispricing was happening. This was a sign that the system is broken. So the same thing with the hoarding of dollars. It's a sign the system is broken. There's a broken system.
Well, the individual wants individual economic freedom. You know, part of the pursuit of happiness clause in the American, I guess it might be one of those founding documents when they talk about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Originally, it was life, liberty, and the pursuit of wealth. And wealth in the sense of independent economic freedom. And everyone would have their own definition of that, what amount of gold they would want in their possession to give them the freedom to vote their conscience. And now, for example, right now, people who are graduating from university with $100,000 or $200,000 in debt, they can't vote their conscience. They can only vote in ways that are going to help them get diminish that debt. And they can only get jobs that pay enough to help them diminish that debt. So they are not economically free to vote their conscience anymore. So they're not free. And that's the problem when you move away from gold. Now, some people may think that I want $20,000 worth of gold, or I want $1 million worth of gold, or 5 or 10 of economic freedom from there. But at some point, you have the feeling that, okay, I am prepared against the government collapse, and governments collapse quite often. I can then be more active in doing things that are non-gold based. But in China, they have an ingrained cultural bias toward accumulating enough gold so that they are economically free. There's a saying that a man makes his fortune twice in China. The first one is made in gold, and then the second one is made, in something other than gold. But there's always, since I've been working on Wall Street and been involved in Wall Street for 30 years, it's always been paper, 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 paper. So this whole idea of gold is relatively new to this generation.
Yep. And by the way, this is Resonance 104.4 FM in London or online globally. Of course, you can listen on resonancefm.com. And I was looking for that design feature thing of gold hoarding that Professor Fiketa had said. The one thing I found was he said that under the gold standard, the amount of gold in circulation tends to be just right. Because if people think there is too much, they could melt, hoard, or export the gold coins of the realm in their possession. If they think there is too little, then they could exercise their constitutional right to free coinage, take their old jewelry or newly mined gold to the mint, and exchange it for gold coins of the realm. The result of this flow of gold from the mint to the refinery and back is the number of gold coins in circulation is always optimal, conforming to the wishes of the people and not to the wishes of the bank or the government. So then he's asked, there tends to be, instead of saying that there's too much or too little gold, it would be more accurate to say that the rate of interest is too high or too low when people start to hoard gold.
Yeah, well, he's basically saying what I'm saying is that the level of gold people have as versus their ability to trade is a dynamic bit of interplay that at some point you want to move away from just having a gold stock to expanding to other areas of the economy until those other areas begin to break down, and you want to go back to building up your gold position, and the price signal between those two elements, the dynamic elements, would be the interest rate, which is the rate of return essentially on gold versus non-gold. But he's saying that since there is no active market in gold right now, we only have a futures market, there is no real cash rate or interest rate applied to gold. So people are just at this point, like in China, since there's no price signal at all, they're just saying, well, I'm just going to buy as much gold as I possibly can until this situation sorts itself out. And the way it's going to sort itself out is and this is a growing clarion call out there, is that the bond market is now starting to break down, as we've been saying for a few years that it would. And it's funny because when interest rates first started to go up a few months ago, of course, the Pollyanna out there on Wall Street and elsewhere are saying, well, it's a sign of economic growth. You see that there's a demand for money and that there's a growth element coming. And so interest rates are rising, bond prices are falling. But now, 6 months later, a year later, people understand that that's not the case at all. It's a sign of a bond bubble bursting. And when the bond bubble bursts, then interest rates go up, not from demand or hope of an economic growth, but from fear of bond collapse. And so that's going to feed on itself. The last time we had a major bond crash was 1994. The bonds lost, if you look at your 10 or 15 year government bond, I believe they lost up to 30, 35% of their value. My expectation for the, because they started, the yield started at 8%. And they dropped down to, I think, something like 5.5, 6%. And that was a bond crash. Here we're starting with yields at 2%. No, I got that reversed. The bonds were starting at 6.5% and they moved up to 8%. Here, and that you lost 25 to 30% of the value. Here, you're starting with bonds at 2%. So if you see a move to 4 or 5%, that's more than 100% move up in rates. So that implies the value of the bond crash would be something like 70%, 80%. Of course, that means that every major bank in the world is have to declare that they're insolvent. They're not going to do that because the governments are going to print not 10 trillion, but 100 trillion in dollars. And then finally, the ceiling on gold and silver will be shattered, and those things will go to $10,000 an ounce.
Well, they did warn us very early on up at Davos that the 100 trillion was how much they were going to have to print. And it seems like this bond apocalypse is really starting, as many as you and several of our guests have pointed out, in Japan. It's starting to happen. The gyrations in the Japanese government bond market and also in the stock market have been just wild over the past month and a half.
Yeah, exactly. That Japan is looking like the main area where this thing is exploding. The Abenomics, the three arrows of the Abenomics, don't look like they're going to work. The incredible volatility is happening, and bond yields are inching up around the world, and so there's a lot of instability, and the bond apocalypse is upon us. 1994 is a while ago, so it's due. The bond market's due for a major correction slash crash, and the banks around the world, because they were bailed out with more by extending and recapitalizing the bond market at these artificially low rates. The banks and these governments are—I can't think of a time in the last 200 years or 300 years when they've been more vulnerable. If the governments around the world had simply let these banks default and allowed for new banks to come on to compete, then you would have had 2 or 3 years of a depression. And followed by, we'd already be into a rebound now, and the employment and wages would be going up, and it would have been the horrible depression of 2002 through 2005. Because remember, that's when there would normally be a depression based on economic history, but Alan Greenspan and others lowered interest rates to the absurdly and obscenely low rate of 1% or less for a multiple year period, which created the housing bubble, which then burst. And in response to that, they did exactly the same thing with quantitative easing. They just kept it going and going and going. So here we are in 2013. We've escaped two major recessions or a depression. And now with the bond apocalypse, we're going to have the worst bond wipeout ever.
Yeah, and you just said something that made me think of I forgot. Anyway, so the other story, big story in the press. Oh, you mentioned that the markets would have collapsed, and that was the other thing that I thought of last night when I was listening to, you know, at this protest, where people are talking about how capitalism failed and blah, blah, blah. And that's the sure sign that it's not capitalism, because, of course, in capitalism, according to the rules of capitalism, all those banks and derivatives and bondholders would have lost. That's what would have happened if we had capitalism. So the fact that we didn't means if they're arguing against capitalism, they're arguing against the wrong thing. And that's a big problem, because then the solutions can't be had, because the solution obviously is about incarcerating the banksters. It's a criminal racket is what we have.
Mm-hmm. Like the bond market's collapsing and the global economy is collapsing. And then there'll be something that emerges in the ashes. And it'll probably be this hybrid model that we're already seeing in the crowdfunding space. And both sides will take credit for having won the war. You know, the capitalists will say, crowdfunding is just free market enterprise in a new jar, new bottle. And the socialists will say, you see, social networking is the winner. See, communism won. So both sides will take credit as having won the post-capitalist, post-bond apocalypse crash. But meanwhile, neither one have really contributed significantly to the current debate or the post-bond collapse debate. They're just basically flapping their jaws. The people who are actually doing something are those who are putting forward crowdfunding and Bitcoin-related enterprises that are this hybrid model that will essentially be the only thing left standing when the bond market collapses.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing you see with the NSA has obviously figured it out. Various private corporations have figured it out, and this is why they want to destroy the internet. This is a way for them to destroy the internet without actually destroying it, like unplugging it like an outright dictator. The fact is that the problem for them with social networking and being online and crowdfunding is that they've succeeded over the past few decades, and like I said, restricting the rights to movement, free movement of humans and individuals. And capital is completely free. For an individual to go where the capital is or where the opportunity is, it takes a lot of money, time, effort, visas, naked body scans, all that stuff, where capital can move within a fraction of a second, in nanoseconds, in the case of high-frequency trading. Well, this has opened up markets to the individual, who they've successfully locked out through all their various laws, regulations, borders, immigration checkpoints, and visa requirements. So this has opened up the world, and it's flattened it in a way to the individual, to the markets. So that's what I don't think they like, because they don't like people being able to raise capital freely and trade on ideas and innovate and come up with new things and possibly compete with them.
That's right. So look in the Bitcoin space, as I've been saying, Bitcoin is a remarkable development in human history. And as part of the bond apocalypse, Bitcoin price could easily top $10,000 or even $100,000 per Bitcoin. So then you're going to have thousands of people who are going to be sudden Bitcoin multi-hundred millionaires and billionaires. And those people will rewrite the Constitution and reintroduce the Constitution. You know, it's not a coincidence that most of the Bitcoin community are libertarians and pro-constitutional rights people. And they'll just reintroduce it, and they'll hire the police force to enforce the Constitution and the Bill of Rights as it was originally iterated. And but Bitcoin is, you know, a remarkable savior for humanity, in my opinion.
Well, so then that leaves us with like the remnants of what is this, you know, the old regime. And, you know, we predicted this here on the Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM. We predicted it about 7 years ago. This intergenerational warfare is, you know, the local politics is whoever gets out and vote, whoever gets the vote and votes for the platform they want gets to change. I mean, Thomas Jefferson said that's what democracy is. It's not a republic, it's a democracy, and it's rule, it's like a tyranny of the 51%. And of course, the baby boom generation is an outsized generation, not only figuratively, but literally. And this is why you see things like these student top-up fees. Remember, well, they used to be called top-up fees. Now it's just the huge fee. I mean, it's more expensive to go to university in the UK now than in the US. And the US has had a long history of charging for university. So here you have the end game, as I see it on Zero Hedge, the end game of state local government pensions. We also have the confrontation with this in the midst of a bond apocalypse is the coming, you know, a lot of these people are on the guaranteed benefits that nobody else under 50 really has any guaranteed benefits in their pension schemes. So that's the next conflict. That's the next giant conflict, because across the U.S., the states, the local governments, they have all these huge plans that they're supposed to pay. They're guaranteed. They have the rights to raise taxes in order to pay them, which is what you see in California with CalPERS imposing all sorts of new fees on newcomers and incomers into the schemes. So, you know, where do you think this is going to go in terms of the bond apocalypse? On the one hand, it's going to help in terms of interest rates will rise. So that's good for pensions. But, you know, the sheer amount and the guaranteed benefits for this older generation that expects to retire soon on these full benefits. What do you see happening there?
Yeah, the pension benefits assume, you know, first of all, pensions work by the people coming into it who are working today, they're taxed by the government, and that government tax is recycled into a Social Security benefit in the United States. So it is, you know, it's a Ponzi scheme in that sense. And it's worked for a few decades, many decades. And there's a huge shortfall there, and that shortfall is made up by interest rates that are typically between 5 and 8%. Now, since interest rates have been hovering around 1%, the governments and the major corporations are anywhere between 40 and 60% underfunded in their ability to pay out the pensions for retirees. So they're making that up with things like this student loan that we just described. When they talk about they're going to sell the loans to somebody, and to make those loans attractive, they're going to force students to pay not the agreed upon contractual amount, but something closer to 5 or 6 or 7% interest on those loans to sell the loan package of £40 billion. Who are they selling it to? They're selling it to a pension fund that is undercapitalized. So here you have intergenerational warfare. So the 50-year-olds and 60-year-olds who are faced with getting 50 or 60% less on their pension monthly pension check are lobbying people like Rothschild's Bank to recommend the government that the government convinced that student loans should be recalibrated at double or triple the interest rate and then sold to a pension fund. So the older generation, the baby boom generation, doesn't miss out on any of their pension benefits. And then since those people are have all the power and do all the voting and have all the lobbying, that's what they're going to do. Since then, since the students don't have a lobbying power and don't have any money and don't have any way to influence government, they're going to have to lose out.
Well, you can't say we didn't really see that coming. And in terms of the student loan thing, of course, everybody warned. I remember all the protests out in front of Downing Street. Of course, again, you know, with your placards, everybody goes out there and marches and all against student top-up fees. But placards never work because, of course, you know, with the UK student debt, that'll be packaged and sold to CalPERS, for example, mm-hmm. the California Pension Fund. So it's way over there. And it's your government is helpless, they'll claim. They can't do anything.
Because they signed a contract.
Because they signed a contract. The same thing you've seen over and over in the past few weeks when, you know, the various heads of Google and Amazon and all these, the likes of these sorts. Well, David Cameron has told you, you know, we can't help it. We should have an honest discussion. Obama said that about the NSA program. We should have an honest discussion about this. It's out in the open. These are our laws. These are, i.e. putting it on you, the population, saying these are the laws you want. You want to attract these businesses, don't you? So they don't need to pay taxes. This is the law now. They're not circumventing the law by paying zero taxes. This is what the law is. That should be a wake-up call for you, but obviously it's not because people are drowning in debt. That's the thing, how they keep you trapped. By the way, doesn't it sound like a prisoner? I mean, who else is so helpless? But like a prisoner in a prison where they can just suddenly change the rules and say, well, you're not allowed, you know, your hour of exercise today. And here it's like, well, we're going to just change your interest rate. So right now, students in the UK with debts between 1998 and 2012 incurred between those dates, they're paying 1.5%. Well, the new rate would be like 8%. So that's an 800% increase, 700% increase in the amount you're paying?
Yeah, well, you see, I don't... The government will always say, well, it's not against the law, and they have no choice, and they sign a contract. But I just don't understand why people don't take this on as more as a human rights violation. It's a violation of human rights. It's no different than if some African dictator who slaughters 1 million people ends up in the International Criminal Court and hung, why can't students take a case to International Criminal Court for someone who's going to create an interest rate-based pogrom of annihilation of a population of young people as a human rights violation? And they should go to trial as mass financial murderers, which is what they are. That's a human rights violation. To sit back and say, well, I guess we're going to wave a placard and hope it goes away. I don't see how that's going to work.
And this is another statement from Rothschild's bank, okay? In order to sell as much of the loan book as possible, the financiers, Rothschild, advise that the government underwrite the risk with a financial instrument called a synthetic hedge. In effect, using the public finances to guarantee returns to private investment. So obviously, again, you know, as you're saying, this loan book is going to be sold to a pension fund because that's the sort that buys this. And at the same time, the taxpayer, the new taxpayer, will have to underwrite the risk to yeah. those old taxpayers.
So the taxpayer is having their money stolen by Rothschild Bank. And the government is providing an escort service, an escort of police escort to allow the Rothschild to go in there and steal the money in case anyone, the so-called synthetic hedge, in case anyone tries to attack them for this human rights violation, which is what that means. In other words, the government is protecting them with insurance. If anyone sues them under human rights courts, the government has guaranteed to step in. It's just like, remember, during the Democratic and Republican conventions in America, the police had insurance against being sued. If they were killed somebody or beat somebody up at the convention and they were sued, the government was buying them insurance protection so that they would pay their legal fees if they just happened to crack the skull of some kid and put him into a coma. They were insured, and that insurance was paid for by the government.
And then, going back to the student loan, okay, One indicative calculation suggests that an employee on £25,000 a year, which is the average salary in the UK, perhaps in London, with £25,000 of undergraduate loans, and that's typical because it's over £9,000 a year now, per year, taken out before 2012, could work until retirement without ever paying off their debt if the interest rate cap is removed.
Well, yeah, it's back to, you know, tenant farmer. You know, you're a tenant farmer. So, you know, that's why people love Downton Abbey so much, is because they realize this is where they're all headed.
Well, that's it from The Truth About Markets right here in Belfast, coming to you from the G8, where we're about to go out to the G8, anti-G8 protests, see if the waving the placards does anything to stop this system that you see here that we've discussed. And
yeah, well, I'll tell you one thing that's funny is that, of course, a great example of that would be the Guy Fawkes masks that have been used to show my demonstration against the man. And millions have been sold. And, of course, every single one gets a kickback to Warner Brothers that owns that image.
Yes, and we'll actually talk about Warner Brothers next week because they're being sued about Happy Birthday 2, which they've been collecting royalties on. Apparently, they don't actually own the rights. But that's it for this episode of The Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM.
Bye, y'all.